So the first topic is development of a bi-dimensional dietary acculturation framework for the Hispanic population. Diana Cui Castellanos. Dr. Castellanos is an assistant professor of nutrition and dietetics at Marywood University in Scranton, Pennsylvania. She spent a number of years working in Guatemala as the director of community nutrition and health for a small nonprofit organization and began to work in the area of dietary behavior and acculturation upon her return to the United States. Her other research interests include community-based participatory research and nutrition intervention development, implementation, and evaluation. The next topic is purposeful interaction, a descriptive framework for Latino men's communication about prostate cancer. That'll be presented by Sarah Connor, MPH-CHES. Ms. Connor received a MPH from UCLA School of Public Health and is a nationally certified health education specialist. She is a research manager for the UCLA Department of Urology, where she oversees a variety of federally and industry-funded studies of benign and non-benign urologic diseases. Previously, Ms. Connor was health team manager for IMPACT, California's free prostate cancer treatment program, and as program director for several multi-year longitudinal studies on cancer screening in underserved populations. The next topic is Latino male youth, violence, and access to mental health. Vanessa Cordova, MPH. She received her MPH from UC Berkeley in 2005. Vanessa worked as a sex educator for Planned Parenthood, Marmonte. She then ran support groups for monolingual Spanish-speaking HIV-positive women for a nonprofit, Women Alive Coalition. In 2009, she was awarded Outrageous Activist by Ms. Magazine for her work in HIV/AIDS. Vanessa's graduate thesis was on ethnographic study on Kettleman City residents' disproportionate exposure to toxicity and the need for popular epidemiology. And the last topic is Hombres Unidos, a peer-led intimate partner violence primary prevention project for Latino migrant men. Our presenter is Adrian Velasquez. He's a Family Violence Prevention Initiative Manager for Migrant Clinicians Network, MCN. He has been with MCN for 3 years since graduating from the University of Texas at Austin with a BA in Latin American Studies. Prior to working as the Family Violence Prevention Initiative Manager, Adrian also worked with Health Network, a trans-border patient navigation project with MCN. So first up, Dr. Cui Castellanos.
Good morning, it's good to be here. And so what I'm going to do is, the first thing is, I don't have anything to disclose. This research was done in Mississippi, and it was done during a time, since Katrina, there's been an influx of Hispanics into the area. And so what I'm going to do is, I'm just going to define a few things first, and then talk about the purpose of the research, methodology, results, and then the framework that we built out of this research, and then what we're doing with it now, how it's informing future research and practice as well. So the first thing is, we use a bi-dimensional acculturation model, and this is out of the psychology literature. And what a bi-dimensional acculturation is the grasp two dimensions. So one dimension is cultural maintenance. So how much does one maintain their original culture? And the other is across contact and participation, which is how much is a person participating in their new host culture? And what this bi-dimensional model does then is it develops four different subcategories. So you have people that are, we say they're still in the traditional, which is they're not participating very much in their host culture, but they're maintaining much of their original culture. Then you have, on the other spectrum, you have the assimilated. And those are people that are participating a lot in their host culture, and they have not maintained much of their original culture. The other one is a bicultural group. This group is, they work really well in both cultures, in the host culture, but then also in the culture where they come from. And then the last one is a marginalized group, which they don't feel like they belong in either culture at all. And so those are the different categories. There's also a fifth category that a psychologist has proposed as well, and it's called a separated category, and that's where people have rejected a culture even though they could still be a part of it. So maybe they're accepted in the host culture, but they have rejected that part. And so I'll talk about that a little bit more later on as well. The next one is dietary acculturation. When we look at dietary acculturation in the Hispanic population and you look at prior research, a lot of the research is to measure acculturation. They've used proxies such as time spent in the U.S. or language, and so they use a unidimensional. So you're either low to high acculturated, and you're on one dimension. And what they found, of course, which is that as one becomes more acculturated to the U.S., they start to adapt the dietary habits of the U.S. And so we see like lower intakes of fruits and vegetables as one becomes more acculturated. We see, not that we see higher intakes of fat, but different fats. So you see more dairy intake, also higher intakes of processed foods. So convenience foods, snack foods, fast food, so on and so forth, as one becomes more acculturated. And the last thing I want to define is an operant theory of acculturation. And this is kind of new to the health promotion. And what it says, operant is just voluntary behavior. And then when you think of learning, that's the experiences one has that informs behavior. And so with acculturation, that's just behavior learning as a factor in the in a person's decision on whether to adapt or reject, for me, a dietary behavior. So the experiences I'm going through in this culture right now, is that going to lead me to adapt a new dietary behavior, or is it going to lead me to reject a new dietary behavior? And at the end, really the purpose of this research is what we want to do is identify influencing factors of dietary behavior in Hispanics and look at what are they coming across? What are they experiencing here in the United States that may lead them to adopt unhealthy dietary behaviors, or what might lead them to adopt healthy dietary behaviors? And so what we want to do is figure those out, figure those factors out, and then be able to address those factors and say, wait, well, let's not adopt those unhealthy ones. Let's adopt these healthy ones, or let's retain the healthy ones that you already have. And so that's the purpose. And what you'll see is different pictures throughout my slides. And I'll get into this in just a minute, but one of the methodologies we used was photo voice. And so our participants took pictures of the dietary habits as well as just their dietary environment. So you'll see those pictures throughout these slides. Okay. So our methodology, again, this was done in the southern region of U.S. Our participants were 35 Hispanic males. We just used snowball sampling, which just means we had friends that went out and we worked with a Hispanic church. We worked with Hispanics on the university campus that I was on, and other also through other friends, and then people would identify others that they knew, and so it just kind of snowballed on down. We did have some, it was mostly a qualitative study, but because we were exploring these dietary influences and these dietary factors. However, we did have a few quantitative measures. One of them was the acculturation rating scale for Mexican Americans, too. This was done by M. Queller. Prior research has also used it for all Hispanics, and it showed really good reliability, so we adapted the instrument to include all Hispanics, not just Mexicans, as well. And this acculturation scale creates those four subcategories that I've talked about at the very beginning. It's bidimensional. So you're traditional, you're assimilated, you're bicultural, and then you're marginalized and separated categories as well. Some other quantitative measures that we use the new vital sign food label for health literacy. We use that as a nutrition literacy to look at nutrition literacy in our participants. We also use the fat and fruit and vegetable screener that was for the Hispanic population. So those are some quantitative things that we use, but most of our study was a qualitative study, and we use grounded theory to guide the methodology of the study. And first thing we did was semi-structured interviews with 35 Hispanics. So these interviews lasted anywhere between a half an hour to an hour and a half. After we did that, we began to transcribed all everything. We began to code our data. We began to look for main themes and extract some categories as well. And then we did photo voice. And so here we went back to our 35 participants. We asked if they wanted to continue to participate. We had 14 participants that continued to participate. gave them all cameras and said, for 2 weeks, go out and just take pictures of what you eat, take pictures of your food environment, when you go to the grocery store, when you go out to eat, just whenever you think of food, take a picture. So they came back, we developed the pictures, and we identified from each participant pictures that were kind of different. Laid them all on a table, and so we had our participants that were in the traditional group, we had participants that were in our bicultural group, and we had participants in our marginalized group, and we had three separate focus groups with them, laid out the pictures, and then asked questions around those pictures. And so that was very, that just was really the heart of our data. We got some very good data that way. And I want to mention also is we actually did not have an assimilated group. We had one participant that actually fell in that category, and we believe it's just from where we are. We're in southern Mississippi. It's really a newer immigrant population in that area of the United States. For our analysis then, again, we used qualitative. So we did open and axial and selective coding. There were three coders. It was myself and then two others that also helped me with the semi-structured interviews, with the photo voice interview, or with the focused interviews. And they were each Hispanic. So, and both worked at the university as well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the results. Again, our acculturation categories, talking about the characteristics. So this I thought was something that was very interesting. We actually had 19 participants in the traditional category, and 12 of them made less than $1,200 or $1,500 a month. Their average household size was 5.1 people per household. Education, only three of them had gone to college out of 19, so it was high school or below for most of them. The average length of time in the United States was 7.6 years, and a lot of them had migrated to the U.S. voluntarily looking for jobs. Our bicultural group were students and then also professionals, and they had we had eight in that group, and they had all come to the United States looking for better education. And so they had come also voluntarily. And their average household size was about 2.1 people per household, and all but the three students that were in this group made over $1,500 a month. Our last group that we had was a marginalized group. They either came as a child with their parents, or they were second generation. So this is the only group that we actually had second generation participants in. They were military, they were professional, and they were also, some of them were students. They made, except for their students, made over $1,500 a month as well, and most of them had families and here in the United States. Okay, so what I'm going to get into a little bit now is our framework. So this dietary acculturation framework that we that came out of our data analysis, that came out of the grounded theory methodology. So first thing that we looked at was our acculturation categories and how could they predict dietary behavior. And what we found was with our acculturation categories, two other big dietary influencing categories came out. One of those was the interpersonal diet-related factors, and the other was the environmental-related factors. So I'm just going to go on to the framework so I can explain a little bit of this. So what we saw is that the acculturation, so depending on their acculturation group, that could really predict diet-related interpersonal factors. So with this, you had values, attitudes, beliefs, knowledge, and norms around dietary behavior. That also reflected the reaction to this environment that they were in. So food availability, food accessibility, cost of food, which was paired with their income, time that they had to prepare food, living structure. So were they living with a wife and kids? Were they living on their own? Were they living with extended family? Were they living with roommates? And then also skill around cooking. And then this then would lead to what type of diet, you could predict what type of dietary pattern they were in, or describe the dietary pattern based on these factors. Okay, so I'm going to give you all a few examples. So let's take the traditional group. Let's start there. So what we saw was with the traditional group, thing that they valued, it was very important that they were eating traditional foods. So they talked about their identity under their traditional foods. They talked about how much they missed their mom's cooking if their mother was not there. Also their attitudes. They had very negative attitudes, not very, but they had negative attitudes towards the food in the United States. They're like, they don't taste the same. They're not as fresh. They're all processed, so on and so forth. They believed that it was a woman's role to cook, and that they were struggling with that a little bit. Just saying, like, you know, if their wife or their mother was not there, we had, you know, a quote from a guy talking about how his roommate would come in, it would be his turn to cook, and he would say, no, I'm not cooking. This is not my role. We're all going out to eat. And so that night, they would all go out to eat when it was his turn to cook. Knowledge. So they had their nutrition literacy was the lowest out of all three groups. So they had a low nutrition literacy. And then the norms were the traditional foods. So then availability is they felt like there weren't fresh fruits and vegetables. They felt like there wasn't a variety of fresh fruits and vegetables. Their access to them was a little bit lower. Some of them did not have transportation, so they would have to wait on their friends to take them to the stores. Also, cost. This one was an interesting one in this group because they felt like fruits and vegetables were very expensive comparatively, but they felt like meats were not. And they said that, you know, back in the countries where they were coming from, they couldn't afford meat. And here they could. And they got some kind of identity from that of like, I can afford meat. And so even though when they were talking about what was good for them and not, they'd be like, oh, meat's not good for you. But now I'm eating it every day. And so they were getting something from that. Time, they felt like they did not have time to cook a lot, though they were trying because they really did not like to eat out. And so what they were doing is just using more processed traditional foods. They were like, you know, like back in my home country, my mom would make fresh mole. Well, now we get mole, but it's from a jar. So it doesn't taste the same, but at least it's the same food. Living structure, again, a lot of our traditional down in the South are living with roommates or living with some type of extended family. And so they talked about that, just living with the other roommates. And then skill, there was a lack of cooking skill, though they were trying. They were talking about calling their mom and being like, Mom, can you give me this recipe and I'm trying to make it? And they were like, it never is like my mom's, but at least it's something. I was like, whose food is like your mom's? Like, come on. So that's a hard one. And then I'm going to get into what the dietary patterns look like in just a minute. So going through the bicultural and the marginalized very quickly, bicultural, they really valued health and that they were eating healthy foods. Their attitudes toward the foods was that of they were really struggling with there was a lack of social interaction during mealtimes. That came out very strongly in this group. Also, their beliefs is that, you know, everyone kind of shared the responsibilities around food. They had a very high nutrition literacy. And they felt like with the food availability, again, there wasn't as available fruits and vegetables and things of those sorts. But they liked different ethnic foods as well, so they kind of would try in different things. Accessibility, they had transportation, though they struggled a little bit with the cost of food. They felt like it was a little bit more expensive. Time, they felt like they didn't have time to really make like homemade food, but they did the best they could, and they didn't like to eat out very much. So they would always talk about, you know, we'll eat out once or twice, and we'll go to like different restaurants because we like different foods, but we're really trying to eat healthy, and we feel like eating healthy means eating in the home. Living structure, they were mostly had their families, wives, kids with them, and then skill, they had some skill in the kitchen. And then marginalized group had they really valued taste. So their preference was a taste. Their attitudes was, they had a really negative attitude around the foods that were available to them. They believed that everyone shared the responsibility. Their knowledge was moderate when it came to nutrition. So their availability was that they liked a variety of foods. They were okay. They had accessibility to different foods. They didn't feel like there was anything they were really lacking. Some of them did talk about just lacking some of their traditional foods. Cost, time, they were eating a lot more of processed foods because they said they just didn't have time to make other foods and they were very busy. Living structure, they were either with roommates or with families as well. And the marginalized, I saw the ones that were with families, we had like a so biracial marriages, and so a lot of them were married to women from the United States. And so they were okay with those foods, though they were talking about trying to teach their wives to cook their traditional foods, but they said it wasn't working out very well. You had that from a few of the different men. And their skills, this one really came up that they barbecued. So they liked to barbecue, and then some of them were trying to cook some of their own foods as well. So then dietary patterns. So this is, again, exploratory. It's very qualitative. So this is something that we would have to test later on. But what we found is with that traditional group, they had more of the modified traditional diet. So diets that were still high in fiber. They had lots of beans, corn tortillas, so on and so forth. Traditional Hispanic dishes, only their traditional dishes were made mostly of like processed ingredients. They did consume some convenience. They talked about going in the mornings and going down just to the convenience store before work to get convenience foods and sometimes fast foods as well. The bicultural group was more of the bicultural diet. They had a combination of traditional Hispanic foods as well as Western foods and foods from other cultures. They talked a lot about loving Thai food and Indian food and different foods as well. And then our marginalized group and separate group, they were mostly the modified Western. So mostly Western. They talked some about different traditional dishes. They actually talked about eating some fruits and vegetables because of their kids, because they were trying to influence their kids and give their kids a positive example for their children. But they talked about how most of their foods were processed or convenient and that they ate out a lot. So they said, you know, they come home from work and their family, they would go out to eat. So what we've done with some of this data, we've developed an instrument looking at the interpersonal and the environmental factors. And so we're in the middle of, we've just finished testing the instrument for reliability, and it showed good reliability. And so, again, it looks at the different values, attitudes, beliefs, knowledge, so on and so forth. Also, food accessibility, availability, cost, time, skills. So we can go in. What we can do is if we're with a client or if we're with a group of Hispanics, we can give them this instrument, they can rate it, and then we can kind of see where they are. So what different factors are negatively or maybe positively affecting their dietary intake. So just in conclusion, we see that acculturation, and I really liked the bidimensional acculturation instead of looking at a unidimensional, looking at this bidimensional acculturation measure does predict dietary behavior, and I should not use the word predict just because, but it does describe dietary behavior. Identifying these influencing factors, by identifying these influencing factors, we can then create interventions or to address factors that may be negatively impacting them. So going back to that operant theory of acculturation, going, okay, which experiences are informing negative dietary behavior and which experiences are informing positive dietary behavior, and really trying to focus on those that are informing negative and addressing those experiences that they're having. And so that's kind of where we're at right now in this research. So we'll be taking questions at the end, but thank you all for your attention and for coming this morning, and I'll wrap it up.